like me to sit?
Come forward.
Come forward. Shall I sit there? I can address the room, or
no?
No, here, right here. Yep.
Right here, and
oh, the microphone.
If you could, if you could come, to the,
come right there.
Yep. This is recording.
Oh, okay,
thank
sure.
You.
All right. My name is Mark Skate. Just by way of background, I'm a Queenstown architect. I've lived here for probably close to 30 years. In a former life, I was an economist. I have a master's degree in economics from the London School of Economics. I've worked as an economist for the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, and I've also worked for the Centre for Resource Management, dealing with planning matters and resource consent and resource management in general. My submission is in response to Metacarry Lodge's submission seeking to be rezoned rural visitor zone under stage 3B of the QLDC proposed district plan. Metacarry Lodge's current submission is similar to its proposal in stage 1 of the PDP, where it sought to be rezoned as a visitor accommodation subzone of the rural lifestyle zone, a proposal which was ultimately rejected by QLDC on the recommendation of the independent commissioners in their report dated March 2019. The commissioners rejected both Metacarry's inclusion as a subzone as well as a subzone in its entirety. Their decision is directly applicable to the current submission by Metacarry and leads to the same conclusions with respect to the rural visitor zone. Stage 3B of the PDP introduces the rural visitor zone, whose purpose is to provide for visitor industries activities in remote locations within the outstanding natural landscapes. The zone's objectives, policies, and rules are permissive of substantial development, with visitor accommodation as a permitted activity, with buildings up to 500 square meters as a controlled activity, and with very few rules in regards to number of visitors, patrons, or commercial and recreational activities. The two stated objectives of the RVZ are visitor accommodation within appropriate locations that maintain or enhance the values of ONLs, and buildings and development where landscape character and visual amenity are maintained or enhanced. At the time of my original submission, the rules for the zone were very inadequate to support these lofty objectives. This led to the conclusion reached by landscape architect in the QLDC Section 32 report for the RVZ, Helen Melslop, who stated, "More stringent controls over location, density, height, external appearance, and landscaping of buildings would be required to ensure that the development within the zones was successfully absorbed within the landscape." Also, there were no guidelines at that time on how to determine where exactly these RVZs should be located or how they should be selected. This led me to suggest in my original submission that the RVZ is just a carve-out and planning cop-out. In other words, rather than explaining how and why and where the proposed visitor activities could be conducted without detriment to landscape and amenity, the special zone just defined this to be so, and having done so, it could allow those activities as permitted or controlled activities. The objectives and policies of the proposed RVZ simply stated that development in the identified sites would be sympathetic to the environment, but they did not provide an explanation of why this is the case and why these sites, rather than other possible sites, are singled out for the special zoning. Since making my original submission, QLDC has tried to address this problem by suggesting that RVZs need to be identified through landscape assessments, which identify and select only the low to moderately sensitive areas of the ONL as candidates for the RVZs. This approach is flawed. The landscape does not discriminate between visitor buildings in an RVZ and residential or other types of buildings outside an RVZ. Landscape assessment can therefore provide no rationale for treating visitor buildings separately and preferentially over other buildings, or development in an RVZ differently from outside an RVZ. In other words, are there all buildings located in low or moderately sensitive parts of ONL should be able to benefit from the permissive planning provisions afforded to visitor buildings, or all buildings in such areas should be subject to the general planning provisions that apply to the rural general zone? To suggest a separate landscape assessment for visitor buildings introduces inconsistency and contradiction in the district plan. On rural ONL land, the district plan provides provisions state, the applicable activities are inappropriate in almost all locations and successful applications will be exceptional cases. By contrast, in the RVZ, it is envisaged that visitor industry will be a permitted activity and buildings a controlled activity on all low to moderately sensitive parts of the ONL. That is far from being exceptional. It opens the floodgates for development of the ONL. I am therefore led back to the conclusion. Actually, I'll just pause there for a minute. The other question I have is that we have a permitted activity status proposed for the rural visitor zone of 500 square meters total building footprint. But what happens when that is exceeded? We have a controlled activity status of 500 square meters building footprint for the RVZ. But what happens when we are above that? My understanding is that it becomes a discretionary resource consent. But what are the assessment criteria? Where in the RVZ are the assessment criteria for buildings in excess of 500 square meters total building coverage? In the rural general zone, there's a whole list of criteria outlined for assessments of buildings in the ONL. But for the RVZ, there's absolutely zero. So we're told they'll be discretionary, but where are the assessment criteria? Am I to understand that we go back when the building coverage is more than 500 square meters to the provisions and the assessment criteria of the rural general zone? I don't know, but it's a question that I think needs to be answered. I am concerned about this question of the differential between the planning provisions for the RVZ and those of the rural general. And because I can see no basis for it in the landscape assessment, I'm therefore led back to the conclusion that despite QLDC's attempt to do so, there is in fact no proper justification for the RVZs. It is the result of a planning approach based on putting different activities in different boxes or zones with little regard for the relationship or consistency or coherency of their overall arrangement. It seems to me the correct role of planning is to provide a means to protect common interests, assets, and attributes that are shared by an area, zone, or community, and which individuals are incapable of protecting when acting individually. In this approach, integrity of the zone is achieved by consistency of the planning provisions, not separate treatment for separate boxes. I turn now to Matakari's request to be rezoned as rural visitor zone. Matakari Lodge is not on land classified as ONL in the rural zone. It is in the rural lifestyle zone, surrounded by rural lifestyle and rural residential properties interspersed with pockets of popular Department of Conservation Recreation Reserve and adjacent to popular boating area of Lake Wakatipu. This location exacerbates the problem of inconsistencies and conflicts of the RVZ with the surrounding zone. A, landscape and building density. Building density in the rural lifestyle zone is limited to 1,000 square meter building platform per allotment. Matakari Lodge seeks a bespoke RVZ building density of 2,500 square meters, 5 times greater than QLDC's current provision in the RVZ and 2.5 times the allowable building footprint of the rural lifestyle zone. This proposed building density of 2,500 square meters is that same as that requested by Matakari in the rural lifestyle zone submission stage 1 of the PDP. So this question of building density has already been traversed by the commissioner's decision to decline the subzone. The commissioner's first reason for rejecting this building density was as follows. The commissioners in paragraphs 41 to 44, in relation to the rule which provides for visitor accommodation buildings in the visitor subzone as a controlled activity, state, in a practical sense, the application of this rule in relation to Matakari Lodge would enable a further 576 square meters of building coverage, subject only to conditions that would appear to enable some control of the size and shape of individual buildings and require landscaping. Looking at the strategic policies in chapters 3 and 6, it is clear that the provision for visitor accommodation outside the urban areas is contemplated only where they would protect, maintain, and enhance landscape quality, character, and visual amenity values. I carry on with the quotation. This rule does not enable consideration of any of those characteristics. The commissioners conclude, we are satisfied that a controlled activity status for such visitor accommodation would be inappropriate. In our view, only by having the ability to refuse consent will the council be able to achieve the policies of the PDP when considering applications for visitor accommodation in the VA, in the visitor accommodation subzone. Since that report was written, Matakari Lodge has commissioned a landscape report by Rebecca Lucas, suggesting the site is able to absorb more development than at present. But as explained by Christine Birch, this is contradicted by other statements Ms. Lucas has made in the past, in which she claimed that the landscape of Matakari had been transformed by existing buildings. It is also contradicted by other landscape architects' evidence, which Christine has presented, stating that Matakari buildings had a significant adverse effect on landscape quality and rural amenity. Either way, the point made by commissioners is that such a large building coverage needs to be the subject of proper assessment beyond the limited matters of a control, such as landscaping and building size that are available to QLDC for controlled activities. This level of building coverage in the rural lifestyle zone needs to be able to be declined or properly controlled through a discretionary consent process. The second reason given by the commissioners to reject the proposed 2,500 square meter building density rule is that no justification has been provided for differential building density for visitor accommodation buildings compared to building density for the surrounding rural lifestyle zone. To quote them, they say, the rule creates inconsistency with other provisions in the rural lifestyle zone. No evidence has been provided to justify the differentiation between allowable coverage in the visitor accommodation subzone versus that allowable elsewhere in the rural lifestyle zone. As explained earlier, a landscape assessment cannot provide a justification for such a differentiation. It can give guidance on the level of development, but not the type of development. The landscape does not differentiate between visitor accommodation buildings and residential buildings. Therefore, in the absence of evidence demonstrating special qualities of the Matakari site which make it less sensitive than the neighboring sites, either all the sites in the area would have to be allowed the higher 2,500 square meter building density of the RVZ, or they would all, including Matakari, need to stick with the prevailing 1,000 square meter density of the rural lifestyle zone. Effects on rural amenity. Matakari Lodge is not an isolated rural site. It is in a rural living zone with about 100 residential properties within a 1.5 kilometer radius. It is adjacent to and in direct line of sight of a popular reserve, car park, and picnic area, which sees hundreds of visitors every day in summer. And it is adjacent to Lake Wakatipu, where it is seen by hundreds of visitors every day, e.g. on the TSS Earnslaw and the Real Journeys catamaran. It is therefore necessary to consider effects of visitor activity on adjacent sites other than landscape effects. For example, the effects of guests, vehicles, restaurant patrons, goods, deliveries, staff, associated commercial and recreational activities. The potential adverse effects from visitor activities in the rural lifestyle zone is recognized by the district plan, and therefore they are required to be assessed. By contrast, in the RVZs, these activities are assumed to take place in a remote location with few, if any, adverse effects on neighbors. The RVZ, consequently, has no framework for assessing such effects, and they are generally a permitted activity with very little control. The planning provision for effects on rural amenity in the RVZ, like those for built form, are therefore inconsistent with the planning provisions for the rural lifestyle zone, and this renders the RVZ unsuitable for the Matakari site. Matakari Lodge describes the general area it is located in as having a special sense of naturalness or wildness. I agree with this assessment. It seems untenable to me to suggest that the proposed scale of visitor activities for Matakari Lodge as a RVZ, with at least 2,500 square meters of buildings, public dining, and other controlled commercial recreation activities, informal airport, staff, goods, deliveries, and other associated vehicle movements, will not erode this natural wild character of the area. But even if we assume this is not the case and accept Mrs. Lucas' statement that all this development has no adverse effects on the special character of the area, it follows that other nearby sites in the area with similar landscape sensitivity could and should also be allowed development on that scale. But if this were to happen, then there can be not a shadow of doubt that the landscape and amenity sorry, I'm finding this a bit putting off all these doors opening and closing.
When you get Mr. Skye, we'll go to see you.
Yeah. So what I've said is that even if we assume that it's true that a landscape architect can say that there will be no adverse effects from the proposed level of development at Matakari Lodge on the surrounding area, it would follow that other nearby sites, from by that same logic of landscape assessment, that other nearby sites with a similar landscape sensitivity could and should also be allowed development on a similar scale. But if this were to happen, then there cannot be a shadow of doubt that the landscape and amenity of the area would be destroyed. You know, I'm saying if you've got 100 houses in that area, 100 sites with similar landscape sensitivity, you're going to all allow them to develop to that level proposed by the RVZ. Well, I don't think there's any landscape, no matter how much landscape architect, no matter how much you pay them, who's going to say that that has no effect on the quality of the landscape. I am therefore led to the conclusion that to rezone Matakari Lodge as RVZ, whilst retaining the lower density of development of the rural lifestyle zone for the surrounding sites, is to enshrine a parasitic relationship between Matakari and its surrounding zone, in which it alone is allowed to breach the rules that protect the environment whilst benefiting from the adherence to these rules by the surrounding sites. I can understand that visitor industry wishes to have a level of planning certainty and permitted activity status in the rural zones, but I concur with the commissioners of Stage 1 who rejected the idea that the permitted development can be set at a level far in excess of that of other comparable activities of the zone they are located in. I also concur with them that the planning framework and zoning which provide for permitted visitor activity need to be those that already prevail for the surrounding zone rather than a separate, parallel, and preferential framework in conflict with the prevailing existing provisions and zoning. In the case of Matakari, the problem is not that the planning provisions of the rural lifestyle zone discriminate unfairly against visitor accommodation. Rather, it is the unrealistic expectation of its owners who seek continuous growth far beyond the density envisaged for the rural lifestyle property the property is located within. I suspect the same is true for many of the other applicants in the rural zoned ONL who have sought to be rezoned as RVZ. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the RVZ is being used by such people as a vehicle to bypass the provisions of the district plan. It should not be allowed to be used in this way. The only place I can see for the RVZ is for properties such as Walter Peak and Arcadia, which have a history of visitor activity going back far before the RMA and be considered relics of history, and as such can be legitimately treated as exceptions to the district plan. For all new aspirants, the door to the RVZ should be firmly closed and they should be made to use the planning provisions that everyone else has to use. Yes. Barry Croft Road.
We've been to visit Matakai. It was a quiet day. Is that right of way too narrow for two vehicles to pass comfortably? Or are the places where vehicles can pass one another on
There have been problems with safety on the right of way, and Matakari has tried to control it with some signs. I personally have had a few close calls, but there has been requirements in the past under previous resource consent for that right of way to be properly widened, but it has not happened for one reason or another. In regards to the right-of-way, I think there are two points that Christine wanted to make. One was it's the character of the area that we're looking at. This, without Matakari Lodge, this would be a very quiet road serving just a very small number of properties. With the scale of development proposed in the RVZ, there will be hundreds of vehicle movements per day on that road. It changes the character of the road and therefore of generally of the area. The other point Christine wanted to make, which she told me she did not make, was that that is a private road all the way from the Department of Conservation turnoff through to our property is a private road, and normally we would be able to control that as a private road. However, if you allow commercial activity on the Matakari Lodge site, it has to be open to the general public, with the result that vehicles, anyone can drive into that road. And they drive in, they come to Matakari Lodge, turn off sign. Some might go in there, but a lot of them carry on. And they come onto our property. We've had a case of where vehicles have come right down onto our house, right past our house, actually bumped into our house and driven out, got stuck, all kinds of scenarios. So that is one problem with the right of way that results from public use through commercial activity. Yes. Yes.
Another thing I think it's really mentioned in your submission was about car parking and vehicle parking spilling out beyond the Matakari site, is
there? Yes, I did make that submission. My registered submission. No, the point I was making there was actually the Matakari Lodge is overflowing its site already. They have an agreement with the Department of Conservation to use quite a large area of the dock reserve for their own purposes. They have two temporary buildings located there, and they have car parking located there. To me, that suggests they are very close to the physical limits, let alone the environmental effects limits of their site.
Again, that's changing the character, amenity of that area generally.
A little bit. I mean, they've tried to screen off that Department of Conservation area, but it is still visible. The intersection is poor, but that's very difficult to do something about that. You know, the intersection with the state highway is too steep, and you can see the scrape marks from goods deliveries, etc., on the main road.
Thank you very
much. Thank you. Thank you. I've left a copy of my statement. Thank you.
Pop back up. No, that's fine. I propose that Mr. Skelton answer any questions first, and then we'll move to Mr. Freeman, who will also respond on the question from Commissioner Dawson about the dwelling enabled on the 250 square metre lot. Yeah, Mr. Skelton's comfortable to go straight to questions if that suits the panel.
Yes, and all of Arthur's Point, for that matter, would. There's an environment court decision that you might be familiar with, 2002, with Glendu Bay and Hill End Station, where they're defining the landscape category boundaries there, and they set a spatial 1.5 by 2 kilometer rectangle, saying that a landscape must fit inside that rectangle. And Arthur's Point, there's no part of the terraces that are separate from Mount Dewar, Shotover River, any of the O&Ls or O&Fs in that area that would be large enough to hold a landscape in its own right. So I think if Arthur's Point wasn't developed, it would be part of the O&L. Very limited flatland in the village area, being that land, you know, above the onsen, where the terrace comes up from the Shotover River. I'd imagine a lot of that might actually be man-made flatland, but I don't have any evidence to support that. But I think that a lot of that land is sort of rolling. It's not a very large flatland. There isn't much flat area between that terrace and the toe of the Harris Mountains. But I would agree that it does have a higher capacity to absorb development on the flatlands. That's mainly due to the fact that you would need to implement so much earthworks to do any sort of development. Not necessarily. Yeah. It would require less earthworks to do any development on the flatter lands. In terms of visibility, though, this subject site and, you know, most of the other sites to the east and west of it, development on those sites isn't going to increase the visibility of built development in the Arthur's Point Village. It might increase the density of visible built development, but any development on this site itself wouldn't be viewed in isolation. You'd still see Bolandale, you'd still see the larger buildings that are on the flatland below it. And that's evidenced in our photographs, 1 through 8, but it is attached to my evidence in chief. Yes, I am.
So, I mean, when I look through your evidence, most of you are talking about that site. But as I understand, in your client's submission is that the 8 to 12 metre height provision should be able to apply to all of the medium density zone in Arts Point North. Now, your client site is quite a big chunk of that, but there are other sites down below the terrace, dropping from the flatland down towards the Tauranga River, for example, which are also zoned medium density. Can you point me to where in your evidence you look at the effects of this, of these changes, both of them, but particularly the higher one, on the whole of the zone?
I have not. I've looked specifically at the Arthur's Point Wood site.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So, and there is no, as I think we discussed earlier this morning, Arthur's Point North. Do we know where the boundaries of Arthur's Point North are?
Mr. Leakey has helped us define that for
right.
the purposes of this rule. I mean, that's the map.
Mm-hmm.
Your client site is up here, but there are other bits of medium density in that zone, which your client is asking to have this rule apply to. But you haven't looked at those.
No, I've just looked specifically at this site.
You just indicated in your statement about the, you mentioned a hard edge in the ORL. Is that a good standard practice, a hard edge between 8 to 12 metres and an ORL?
In natural environments, I consider it is a good practice. I think that it contrasts better, so it actually shows a dense urban area and then a highly natural area, and that contrast better highlights and creates a clear demarcation between the character areas, and I think it better highlights the values of both.
You wouldn't slope it in with that?
No, I think you see that in Little Mount Iron, where it's more rural residential, and it's hard to figure out where the more natural area and the more residential or rural living areas start and finish, and I don't consider that to be an appropriate response. I think over on the western side of Mount Iron, where there is quite a hard edge between the more natural and urban, or even at the eastern edge of Mount Iron by Albertown, that's where you can see a quite clear separation in character areas, and I think that better highlights I'm in the natural environment, I'm in the rural living or the living environment.
Thanks very much. That example is really helpful. Also, another thing you mentioned is the difference between just exploring the difference in the 8 meter height and 12 meter height building, and the difference in effect is negligible. And essentially, that's a half as much gain. So, how much would be significant?
Well, on sloping sites, a flat site. It can just go up and up, but sloping sites, it actually pushes buildings out a bit more than it does up. So it allows a longer elevation that would be perpendicular to the slope. It also allows, if you're a developer and you have an 8 meter height, then you almost just want to step up the slope with flat roofs. It makes it difficult to have then a gable that could pop out, because that gable could protrude through that 8 meter height limit. With a 12 meter height limit, it allows you to have that gable, and as a restricted discretionary, I think the character of the building would be considered, and how its visual effects would be weighed against a potential 8 meter building that might be flat and not perpetuate any sort of character. I think maybe Ms. Millsop and I disagree that the Arthur's Point, especially the Arthur's Point Village area, does have an alpine character. I consider it does. Though there may not be a distinct architectural style, just the sense of place there is of an alpine environment.
And can I just clarify, you disagree with us. So you say, in your view, it does have an alpine character.
It does have an alpine character, although not a distinct architectural vernacular.
Essentially a contour line by
is following. So can you just clarify the question for me, please, Mr. McLeod? I have a map of the site.
Maybe the, if I can help out, it may be the adjoining site away from town, not part of the sort of knoll type. The Stuart Ledge.
And if I could just see, while we're on that knoll landform to the east, Ms. Melsop states that there's no vegetation or landform that would prevent skyline breaches or ridgeline breaches, but that landform there would prevent any skyline or ridgeline breaches, especially from Maligan's Road. It's important to note that any 12-meter height limit and 8-meter height limit isn't going to change the visibility of buildings from eastern approaches, including Little's Road as Little's Road drops down. And then from the west, there really isn't any landform, but there really isn't much in terms of public places to the west where a skyline or a ridgeline breach could occur. Beyond 12.
Or below 12. I mean, I'm just wondering what the frame was that you looked at to say that from a 12 metres it would be acceptable from a landscape point of view, or a 10 metre or a 14 metre would be acceptable.
Well, the three stories is sort of the consideration that I would have as a three-story building, and whether that would actually be possible on a steep sloping site like this. And at 12 metres it would be, at 8 it would not. And I haven't actually done the full, extrude the existing landform and then design a box or a rectangle in there to test it. But I've been to site, so it's quite practical when you're on site to see and feel what a 3-meter high building would feel like in terms of the context of the existing landform. And I think the 20-meter setback too means that you're not going to end up with 12-meter high buildings screening parts of the O&L more than an 8-meter high building would.
I was going to ask you about Mr. Melsop's view about not having a net here, and your view is just different. So is it obviously that you and Mr. Melsop just have a different viewpoint? I mean, was the methodology or approach, the way you look at this, different?
No, I don't believe there was any different methodology.
It's just you got a different view, that's all it is.
I have a different view. Yeah. I think that in terms of the character of place, I have a different view. I think that village character is alpine, even though a lot of the architectural forms, the most recent ones being the ones next to the new cargo, the Gantleys. They're large, boxy buildings. They're not not alpine in character. Bullendale certainly is. Shotover Lodge is chunky timber, gable forms. And that's part of the Arthur's Point Real Visitor Zone used to encourage that.
I'll just start off first with the question from Commissioner Dawson regarding dwellings on a site less than 250 metres net. So in discussion in the break, one way to solve the issue of someone trying to put a house on a right of way or an access lot potentially could is to add in brackets excluding access and utility allotments, to make it clear. Probably the second issue, if you do have an access allotment, generally probably going to be between 3 to 5 metres wide. You'd still have, if someone could build on that, they'd still have setbacks and coverage and high recession plans to apply. So I think probably, excluding access and utility allotments would be the way to deal with that. And then just moving quickly on to the discussion with Mr. Scouten concerning the 12-metre height limit. 12 metres, in my view, allows for a comfortable three-level building. We start getting four levels and 12 metres, it's compromised. 10 metres, you have the same issue with three levels. You're basically having very cramped fall to start height, or people are digging in to go down to get the benefit. So 12 metres, in my view, allows a good, comfortable, quality three-level building.
So that was the requirement, as opposed to design, I suppose.
Yeah. But basically, it's three levels, yes. The other two points, my third point is, obviously the 20 metre setback from the top of the site for where eventually the 8 to 12 metre high buildings could go. Whilst 20 metres kind of horizontally doesn't seem like a lot, if you look at Appendix B to my evidence, which is the latest consent plan, ignoring the allotments that are approved, the topographical layout, 20 metres back from the top boundary, that's between 30 to 40 metres difference in an elevational sense. So looking at it, you're basically that extra height is going to be substantially lower than the top of the site. The other three points that are raised, and it's conscious there, the people behind us waiting to talk, so we can take questions if need be. It's an eight-year lapse period, and the decision is quite clear. Out of the 12 allotments that are subject to that 8 years, two people build, that doesn't mean consent's given effect to for the other 10 properties. So basically, it is 8 years. I tried to get longer, but the eight years is where it landed.
So they all have to build.
Sorry, addresses Arthur's point was and
the two sides.
Yes.
Mr. Skelton's evidence is the QRC side.
That addresses the Arthur's point wood site. Arthur's point wood
site.
Yes.
Thank you.
This is one.
It's compact. So going through that resource consent, it was definitely a primary question that the council plans raised as to could you build on it. So we put forward a range of conceptual drawings indicating a building for 1 to 12. And generally they were a two-level building, and the smallest one, 104, from memory, excluding car parking, the living arrangement was about 70 square metres. So clearly it's not going to be an environment where you live with five kids, but it would suit a single or a couple of person. So basically it's the size of a residential flat in those locations.
And do you find any other places where that has been applied?
So in general, I'm just thinking from a vacant greenfields allotment environment, I'm not site that's been 104 square metres.
And that's fine. And just in relation to, for example, the SAP in Bullens area, you have
yes, I'm aware of it, yes.
And what would be a comparable size of their conversation? I've visited both, I just wanted to get...
Yeah, I'm just assuming with Bullendale, you're probably looking more at a unit title range where you've got probably the bulk of your title is encompassed with built form and probably access in a smallish landscaping arrangement. So in terms of the actual area, I have to check in terms of physically being Bullendale and those top lots.
Because I was just trying to get a version of built form, please.
I can potentially help you. The Bullendale... The principal units at Bullendale in the SHA are smaller than the 104, so the units that have the actual dwellings on them, but they're not much smaller. So as a concept of size, it's roughly Bullendale.
Yeah. Thank you. That's all. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know, I'll try.
Set.
We have to let them know each time.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Tony Coyer from Coyer Architects. I'm an architect, and my colleague here is David Haps from my office. We've been in had an office in Queenstown for 16 years, and approximately 5 years ago, I bought the property at 170 Arthurs Point Road, and under Coyer Investments Queenstown Limited. And then subsequently opened a pizza business, which is Rako Pizzas, there about 3 years ago. Next slide, please. So just as a visual, these are our offices. This was a rezone house we rezoned from or brought down from Christchurch to basically extend the narrative. We're next door to the former Gantley pub. And the idea was to build on the historical nature of the area, and so explored finding an old villa of a period that would be similar. So here we have a shot of our pizza business set up in two 20-foot shipping containers to the front of the property, and we have resource consents for a cafe, bar and offices to the left and right of the pizza container. We were also the architects for the residence to park 48 two-bedroom apartments, and I guess I'd just point out, you know, it's been quite interesting because we've actually bookended a number of different typologies that you might see at Arthur's Point, and I guess, you know, happy with the spread of this. So this is a 12 metre high building. We were encouraged to exceed that height with some of the roof projections through the design review scenario, and we were able to achieve four levels within that 12 metre height.
What's the road number?
Pardon me?
I missed the road number.
The road number, do you know, David? I can't remember, to be honest, but it's closer to Queenstown from our 170 side, so I'm assuming it's around 150 something. So in general, with the proposal, we're in agreement with the proposal and the objectives that have been put forward, and we're really pleased that the change accepted the high density provision that we also proposed under our initial submission, and we think that's the right path to go. And we point to, I guess, to the report also that that also supports additional complementary activities and that could have a positive social and economic effect to the community at Arthur's Point North. And we certainly noticed that with our pizza container and pizza business, and then the recent opening of Cargo Breweries has provided quite a central core for the Arthur's Point community. And I think that's significant in terms of that social fabric that provides. We also agree with the report that mentions the ability and the vision to allow people to live, work and play in the Arthur's Point area. So the provisioning of Arthur's Point North as a separate zone to develop the flat terrace area, we're in complete agreement with that and the objectives of that, of the proposal. And also, I guess, the report points out and recognises the existing activities and character of the Arthur's Point North zone, which has quite a mix of activities, clearly, as you would know. Next slide. So as part of the background, we looked at those activities that already exist at Arthur's Point North. The green activities being the commercial activities, and it's hard to recognise, but one of the squares in the centre of the building is our house, which is 125 square metres. And we're submitting today on the fact that we don't feel that the controls align with the objectives. So the control around the 100 square metre threshold for commercial activity, being a non-complying activity, in our view doesn't sit with the existing fabric, and it doesn't sit with the objectives that we've already outlined. And you can see there, you know, that effectively none of those existing commercial activities would now comply. And naturally, things would grow from this, and it seems to be what the objective of the plan is. Next slide. So we've pointing out, I guess, complete agreement with the objectives, but the rules seem to restrict the commercial development, and there's a differentiation between recreational commercial activity and commercial activity. So the recreational commercial activity, such as bike hire, ski hire, those type of almost tourist operated scenarios, is a discretionary activity under the proposed plan. However, commercial activities such as pubs, cafes, bars are a non-complying activity over 100 square metres. Well, the trouble with that is multiple, in that my own site, which we'll get onto, is 1,800 square metres. 100 square metres would be less than 5% of the site being able to be utilised for commercial activity, which the objective encourages. So there's quite a misalignment there of those. Our view is that the commercial activity should be regarded in the same way as the commercial recreational activities, and this would also be in alignment with the existing fabric of Arthur's Point North. the threshold itself of 100 square metres, I'll come to and illustrate a little bit more on our own site, where we can give an overlay as to what we feel that threshold should be, and how that should be applied. So we might just jump to we might just jump to the next slide, David. Sorry, of our actual buildings,
yeah.
I think.
So that's our site.
So if I refer to Arthur's Point North as our site that we have, and if we can go to the photos of that perhaps. So this is our existing site at the moment. You have our architectural offices on the left-hand side. You have the pizza container in the middle on the right-hand side going onto the courtyard, and then the bar and offices above on the top right, and the cafe to the bottom left. So the cafe and the bar have resource consent approval to last another 5 years. The bar footprint there is 85 square metres alone, and it has 85 square metres of office above. The pizza container is 36 square metres, the cafe is 70 square metres, and the house at about 125. So we've already got approval for 400 square metres, and it's underdeveloped. It's underdeveloped, and my proposal would be that, you know, by having more amenities there, we'll create more of a community and more of a hub, as we're already finding just with two businesses operating successfully there. So in terms of setting the threshold, I feel that it's not so much controlling the aggregate, which is what the 100 square metres does, because regardless of your site, there's only 100 square metres. So it's more about controlling the size of the individual buildings on the site and letting the aggregate be controlled by the discretion of council. So in this example here, you know, we're clearly defining four different buildings, and as a guide, my suggestion would be that 200 square metres is the threshold point per building, not 100 square metres, and again reiterating that the aggregate be at the discretion of council. Naturally, with an evolution of an alpine village, the commercial build-up closest to the road would be greater, and then would naturally filter out, as has occurred with our design for residents to park, where we proposed two commercial sites to the front of the visitor accommodation building. So one of those sites has got resource consent approval and has its floor slab down for a bread shop. So, and again, we think that's just best handled by council through discretion, not non-compliance.
We only asked us for 10 minutes. We didn't
right.
ask for more than 10 minutes.
Right.
But you've already chewed up probably more than that, and we haven't had time to ask any questions yet.
Right.
How many more slides have you got?
I can quickly go to the second point of our discussion. So the second point that we think needs consideration is the height to boundary control. So currently under the rural visitor zone, there is no height to boundary control to the boundaries. It's to the zone boundaries, which is the outer boundary. So if we go to the height to boundary control slide, the diagram. So is that coming up, David?
Keep on going. Another one, please. And another one. And another one. That's it.
So currently the height to boundary control proposal is 2.5 and 45 degrees, which would give you the drawing on the bottom there of the outcome, which we think is an inferior outcome and obviously different from the current proposal. Our proposal was to have a increased setback for increased height so that you'd have a more regular building, which would be more cost effective and less leaky, which none of us like. So three levels, 3 metre setback, 4 levels, 4 metre setback. Jane Turner correctly said that it would be more complicated to initiate it, but saw the merits in it. And I think it could be easily accommodated, though, as an alternative height to boundary control, and that's the same as Auckland Council have initiated, and that's been quite successful. What that does is it allows you to have increased planting in those side yards, which would otherwise not occur. And in summation, quick summation, the national policy statement that's due to come into force in August 2020, points out the need for urban environments to enable all people and communities to provide their social, economic and cultural well-being, and ensuring that the rules are not unnecessarily constraining of growth. And so we see our proposal being in line with that. Thank you.
I'm not sure I have any questions. I think it was quite clear. I think you're quite right to put out this Turner kind of supports a lot of what you're doing, but basically says she doesn't really think it should be done in a bespoke way. It should be done on a broader zone basis. What's your view of that?
I can understand why she wouldn't want to impose a rule developed for a specific proposal across the broad range. But if there's merits in a proposed change, I think there's merits to bring it in, and therefore one of those ways would be to bring it in as an alternative for the subzone and test it with the view to bring it wider. And
so
I think it should be wider.
You could use bike.
Yes.
Bike,
yes. Correct.
This is just recording you all, so it's just an amplification for everybody at the back.
Thanks.
Anything to add to the brief legal submissions that I filed on Friday, unless you've got any questions of me in regards to those. I can start with Mr. Espy. Thank you. My client, as I say, is disappointed in the process. He's here again a second time with the cost involved in that, and it could have been avoided had it been done a different way.
And the other question is, you talk about the nature of the scale or the level of detail of analysis required. Is this an appropriate
Espy's going to go into that a wee bit in his summary with you, but yes, we believe so, based on the landscape values of this particular ONL and its site and the other controls that we propose. Thank you very much, Mr.
Espy.
Yes, he's just got a brief two-page summary, which I'll hand up.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Commissioners. So I'll read my summary through and then happy to take any questions or discussion. So the amended relief that is sought would enable two nodes of development that would consist of farm activities and farm-associated tourism activity, much of which would require discretionary activity resource consent. The station is held by pastoral lease and no tenure review process is in motion or is intended. For clarity, the provision that requires that no built form will be visible from State Highway 6 applies to all development within the Wye Creek Rural Visitor Zone area, so that's the northern area. The proposed maximum built footprint of 1,800 square metres is a maximum for the entire Wye Creek Rural Visitor Zone area, i.e. both sensitivity categories within that area. I understand that a breach of this maximum would comprise non-complying activity. Similarly, the proposed maximum built footprint of 4,700 square metres is a maximum for the entire Loch Linney Rural Visitor Zone area, so that's the southern area, and this includes existing buildings. A significant part of each of the two proposed Rural Visitor Zone areas is mapped as being of moderate high landscape sensitivity, such that development within these areas is fully discretionary. The exceptions are a 1,750 square metre area of flatter terrace landform within the Wye Creek Rural Visitor Zone area and the part of the Loch Linney Rural Visitor Zone area that accommodates the numerous buildings and activity of the existing farm base. The clusters of activity enabled by the proposed zone would be discrete and would be located on small watercourse fans that accommodate improved pasture. Such fans are traditional locations for homestead farm base activities for stations that abut Lake Wakatipu's edge. Indeed, the southern of the two locations already accommodates a farm base. Excuse me. As such, I consider there's considerable logic in relation to the requested situation in terms of landscape character. I consider that the attributes that contribute to the ONL status of the landscape within which the proposed activity areas of zoning sit will not be materially compromised. In relation to visual effects, the northern requested rural visitor zone area will only have significant effects on users of a certain part of the lake's surface. Lake users will visually experience more human modification of the landscape than currently, but this modification will appear in a logical location adjacent to other development on the same small fan, and that's the Drift Bay Rural Living Area, and will be dwarfed by the surrounding mountain slopes and lake surface. The southern requested rural visitor zone area will be visible from the lake and also from some terrestrial viewpoints. In visual terms, enabled development will take the form of the expansion of an existing farm base area. A lake viewer must be reasonably distant in order to get a view of the relevant area. Again, the expanded cluster will have visual logic in that it will be on a modified and improved fan landform which is distinct from the rugged mountain slopes. A State Highway 6 user can gain some views to the southern requested rural visitor zone area as they travel between the Devil's Staircase and Kingston. Views from this stretch of highway are overwhelmingly dominated by the lake surface and the surrounding mountains, and the development that would result from the requested rural visitor zone would be inconspicuous and would only slightly detract from the quality of current views. As mentioned, much of the proposed zoning areas would provide for development up to a specified maximum by way of a discretionary activity. The smaller areas that are not mapped as being of moderate to high landscape sensitivity would provide for development as a controlled activity, but the matters of control are wide-ranging, including, and I list those there, building design, landscape, visual amenity, landform modification, landscaping, and so on. I consider these matters, coupled with the various other applicable provisions, give full confidence that development that will be enabled by the proposed relief will be appropriate in terms of landscape character and visual amenity. The two proposed rural visitor zone locations represent particularly small areas of a vast farming station. The two areas are easily understood when on site and in terms of their land cover, topography and exposure to views. The proposed zoning provisions are also relatively simple. I do not consider that digital contour information or landscape character analysis would lead to any further enlightenment regarding the effects of the requested relief. I consider that those effects are easily understood. Similarly, I do not consider the structure plan approach is justified for these two small areas. In my opinion, the landscape sensitivity categories, coupled with the maximum total footprint provisions, as well as other provisions, provide sufficient certainty that the effects will be appropriate and that the important characteristics of the ONL will be maintained. Thank you.
That's been mapped, obviously, but she's saying, as I understand it, that you really haven't done that thoroughly enough. You haven't done the sort of contour analysis, the visibility analysis, the importance of visibility analysis that would normally be done in order to define those areas of landscape sensitivity more thoroughly than you have. So why do you think that's not necessary for these sites?
Well, really because of their size. I mean, I think that sort of analysis that she's talking about, where we would often maybe have a digital contour model, and that digital contour model could be used to analyse exposure to the lake, for example. You know, there are ways of doing this using digital modelling. That sort of analysis I would come across where a reasonable size zoning is proposed, and there might be parts of that zoning that are particularly exposed and parts of it that aren't and what have you. Whereas here we're dealing with two small areas. You know, these are areas that may well be the size of, you know, one activity area of some rural visitor zone in other locations. They're small enough that that the analysis can be done without using digital tools, and that's what we've done. Although the maps that we've shown don't have contour information on them because there is no digital contour information, they've certainly been configured by carefully walking around the site and analysing which parts are particularly level and the most suitable spot for buildings and which parts might need discretion applied to them. So what I guess what I'm saying is, given the size of these areas, I feel the analysis has been done. It hasn't been represented using a bunch of digital analysis, but I don't see how that would help us. I mean, we did consider this quite carefully, and we could have gone away and done all that digital analysis, and I don't think it would lead us to any different conclusions to what we can come to now. I think it's plain enough to see as it is, given the size of these areas.
Even in light of what the RV zones are intended to apply for,
Yes, my understanding is it is still a small zone compared to those other ones, and like I say, I think had we done digital analysis of slopes and contours and gradients, I'm sure the mapping that we'd end up with would be what we've got now. I don't see it would really reveal anything to us.
Boating activity that might occur in the future, and one of the criteria is sort of difficult to see from public places, and which, you know, is difficult to comply with when you've got views of the lake, that the lake can see you. So what's your response to her comment that you're underestimating the visibility and the number of
Well, the areas of the lake from which visibility will be gained are described, and certainly the northern area is visible from, the northern rural visitor zone area is visible from a catchment of the lake, which is the same part of the lake from which you can see the Drift Bay rural living area. And we've travelled through that part of the lake, and I'm also doing work for Homestead Bay, where there is an activity area that provides for a jetty and wharf activity area, which is what Ms. Gilbert refers to. this part of the lake is not well used for recreation. It's very exposed to southerly winds, and it's a very open part of the lake that can get quite choppy. The lake between Jack's Point and Kingston is the lesser used part of the lake as far as recreation goes. It's really quite rare to see recreational use of that part of the lake. Having said that, as has been explained in the evidence, I accept that viewers on that particular part of the lake will see this new node in conjunction with the existing development. And I guess what I'm saying is, due to the amount of development that node will enable and how it's configured on a fan that is already modified and contains development, I don't think that will offend the appreciation of the ONL.
And for the northern area, that's in conjunction with the Drift Bay development, and the southern area is in conjunction with the development that already occurs at Far Country.
Yes, that's right, yes.
The council's position is that there should be no more than 500 square metres of buildings in each zone. So let's take it that we've got two zones here, one in each area, without resource consent being required beyond a controlled activity anyway, so where there's a full assessment of the effects. And your client's asking for 1,800 metres and 1 square metre, I mean, and 4,700 in the other, including the existing buildings.
Yes.
At the second, at the southern side. Now, Ms. Gilbert and the council's legal submissions at the beginning of this hearing stressed the need for any applicant for a zoning to assess the impact, to do an assessment of effects really on the environment, in your case the landscape effects, of the increased building coverage over and above what the zoning normally provides for. So, can you point us to where you've done that? Assess the difference between, say, 500 square metres and 1,800 and the addition of 500 to the southern side as opposed to whatever would be required or be available there?
Well, all I've assessed is the zone as it's proposed by the requester. So in the assessment work that I've done, I've always been considering 1,800 square metres in the northern bit and 4,700 in the bottom bit. That's what I've always assessed.
But not the difference between how that will be perceived and, you know, the...
Well, I suppose not specifically, but looking at the proposed zones as the requester has put them together, there are certain areas in which there's the low sensitivity area, and then there's plenty of area which is the moderate high. Obviously, any building in the moderate high part is going to require discretionary activity consent, regardless of how it relates to footprint areas. Inside the low sensitivity area, I suppose what I've considered is more than 500. As I say, I've taken into account those controls that the council have, which would in practical terms would be a scrutiny of building design and colours and heights and the landscaping required around those buildings, how they tie into the setting and how landscaping can be used to tie them into the setting, and how they relate to those existing buildings. And if building design and colour and height and so on is all scrutinised, obviously that's done in relation to the context in which those buildings sit. So we'd be considering the existing buildings and what these new buildings would add to it. So that's what I've taken account of. I guess I haven't specifically compared that to a maximum of 500. I've simply assessed it as it's been proposed by the requester.
Yes, which is at that maximum.
At that maximum, yes.
You probably said this, but just to remind me, what's the area of buildings in the southern part at the moment?
Yes, I've got that somewhere. Yes, in the southern part, the maximum allowable total is 4,700. The existing footprint total is approximately 1,850, so that would allow approximately 2,850 of new built form. Now, some of that, well, I suppose in practical terms, what's envisaged is some of that would be additional farm base activities in and amongst the existing farm base buildings, and then some of it would be some visitor or tourism type activity in the southern part of that rural visitor zone.
In the southern part of that?
Yeah, sorry.
Of the
sorry. If thinking about the... thinking about the Loch Linney rural visitor zone area, which is the southern, the northern half of that area is the existing farm base area with
which is the low sensitivity area.
That's right. And then the southern part, which doesn't have buildings on it, is the moderate high sensitivity area. So that additional 2,800 footprint area of buildings that's provided for, some of that would be additional farm base activity areas in the low sensitivity part, and some of that 2,800 would be visitor buildings in the moderate high sensitivity part.
You assume that some of those buildings of the coverage might get consent within that lot, the southern part of the site.
Yes. By way of discretionary consent.
Because throughout your evidence, you tend to talk about it is envisaged that, or it's likely to be a small cluster, or it is envisaged perhaps to be. I think you're talking about your clients. Aspirations for that site and where they think the sort of nature of the development that might go on that site. But of course, for a plan change, we can't really take into account what any particular person or even the current landowner envisages or thinks might what be what. We have to look at what if all the development went into the upper, the farm based site, as you called it, or whether buildings are spread throughout the area or whether they're clustered. So to what extent has your assessment been coloured by what you taken to be envisaged or likely to be or probably going to be a small cluster, as opposed to the range of options that are available on the zone?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, those where I put in comments about it is envisaged that this might be or what have you, those comments really are by way of explanation to describe the thing as best we can. But no, I understand what the provisions provide for, devoid of anyone's intentions, what they provide for, and that's what I've assessed. You know, yes, within the confines of the provisions that restrict them, so that, you know, there are these maximum footprint areas and there are parts of the site where it's going to be discretionary anyway. So within those, yes, that's what I've considered. Yes, I mean, those comments about what's envisaged or what's intended, yeah, I understand entirely what you're saying. Those are for description purposes rather than assessment purposes.
The zone says that it's to be predominantly areas of low landscape sensitivity, but neither of these areas are in your mapping. Given that that's what the zone intends, shouldn't this zone be sort of cribbed back a bit in terms of the area, the proportions of moderate to high sensitivity?
Well, it could be, I suppose, in order to accord with that definition, but I don't see how that would actually help the effects on the ground.
I mean, the southern one, it clearly goes to a fence line, so it's a paddock that's included in the higher sensitivity, but is there any reason for the shape of the moderate high sensitivity area in the northern side?
The outer boundary, you mean?
Yes,
the outer. Well, yes, there is. That's really been guided by landform. As I say, we don't have digital contour information, so that's not shown on the plans. But that line is a line of landform which excludes particularly steep land and includes land which is more low-lying, sloping terrace land. So that outer line has been determined by landform.
And similarly, the inner line.
And similarly, the inner line, that's right.
So if you were to make it even bigger, then you might have had to map some of the area outside the outer line as high landscape.
Well, you might have to, or just exclude it, which is what we end up doing, yes.
So you excluded, in that case, the more sensitive areas, but and found a landform contour.
Yeah, that's
that you would feel happy to map as moderate to high.
Yes, that's right.
And then just one final question. You said in your summary, in paragraph 2, for clarity, the provision that requires no building permit to be visible from the state park, from State Highway 6, and I was just struggling to find that provision.
Oh, okay.
Because it's not in Mr. Vivian's text, it's in his attachment.
Okay, all right. So Mr. Vivian's going to tell us about this new provision.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, Mr. Vivian can take you to it. That was in the original, you know, that's not something that's come in at the summary time.
I couldn't find it in
Mr. Vivian's
text, so
yeah, fair enough.
It's evidence in chief.
Clarify too, if I can, Ms. Gilbert's rebuttal. She questioned whether that rule applied to the whole of the zone or just part of it. It wasn't clear when she was comparing the Mr. Espy and Mr. Vivian's evidence. So.
Thank you. I don't have that exactly, sir, although on
the approximation.
On my evidence, I'm looking at Appendix 2, which shows them both. At a guess, I'd say that something like we're maybe 400 metres south of the southern edge of it.
400 metres separation.
Something like that, sir. Well, I think that's been avoided here due to the location of these two areas of zoning. In this location, we have the Drift Bay Rural Living Area. I understand to the south of the Drift Bay Rural Living Area, beside the mouth of Wye Creek itself, there's another resource consent for a building there, I believe, a dwelling. So that would be halfway between the two, be in the gap, if you like. I believe so, yes. We can probably get the details of that, hopefully. But in any event, looking at the photographs that are attached to my evidence and from viewing it from the lake itself, this particular part of the shore, we've got Jack's Point and Homestead Bay, we've got Lakeside Estate, then we've got a bit of a gap, then we've got Drift Bay and the mouth of Wye Creek, and then there's a huge gap heading south from that. So I think that as far as the sort of concept of a void and then a cluster and then a void and then a cluster, I think we're certainly fulfilling that here. Anyone who can see the proposed area will be looking at the Drift Bay subdivision at the same time. Yes.
And it seems like the vast majority of what we were looking at was over around Batagari rather than pasture. Like we walked through the pasture to get to the outcrop, but it didn't seem like the area you'd identified was pasture. Not much of it.
Well, that's probably fair. It's pretty rough pasture. Looking at that Appendix 1, you can see through the hatching, you can see the vegetation. I mean, there's a lot of scattered scrub and regrowth and bits and pieces. That's correct, sir. Yeah.
You haven't tracked on the visibility of the view from the lake. I wondered if the visualisation you presented, if any of them present a rosy view because the site you're looking at is in shadow.
Well, possibly that was just an unfortunate bit of timing there, and also the sun was shining through quite harshly. So, yes, that was unfortunate. I suppose if you compare it to the existing Drift Bay Rural Living Area, again in that photograph, it's because of the shadow, it's quite hard to pick out those Drift Bay houses. But there's a whole number of them there. So yeah, if one's in shadow, the other's in shadow, I guess. But that's the way it was at the time, I'm afraid.
And 6.11, If the building's a recessor,
yes.
What do you actually see?
Yes, looking towards those existing farm buildings from Kingston, plenty of the time I'd imagine they're completely invisible. Other times, depending on light conditions, you'd see a slight dot or reflection. Well, it's not a word that has any particular definition in terms of landscape practice. I mean, that's something that's come up through the examination of this zone, really. It's the first experience I've had of a stipulation being, well, whatever you're doing has to be remote, and if it's not remote, it's not okay. To my mind, I don't really understand that as being a defining factor of a zone. I mean, my understanding of the rural visitor zone in this district is that it provides for the sector of the visitor market who want to have a rural experience. Now, whether that rural experience is quite close to a town or 2 hours drive from a town, I don't see what difference that makes. Yeah, well, I guess that sort of softens it a bit. And my difficulty with it is that different people have a very different consideration of what's remote and what's not remote. Plenty of people coming to Queenstown will consider they're in a remote place.
If they're in Queenstown Bay.
If they're in Queenstown Bay. Other people will need to be on top of a mountain to feel remote. So, yeah, I have a bit of trouble with it as being a defining factor. But I guess bringing it back to the actual effects, I don't see that determines anything as far as effects go here.
Mr. Vivian's got a couple of pages to hand out as well.
I'll try and take you through this quickly, since we're running out of time. So I've just done a summary. In paragraphs 2 to 5, I discuss Ms. Gilbert's comments with respect to the use of Lake Wakatipu there. In paragraph 4, I say that I've boated on Lake Wakatipu for 20-odd years, and that part of the southern arm of Lake Wakatipu is very underutilised in terms of boating due to the southerly winds and even the nor'wester winds. And I'm not sure if the committee have viewed these sites from the water, but if you do want to, I'm happy to take you out. Any excuse to get my boat out. In paragraph 6, I refer to Miss Grace. Rebuttal evidence about the size of the lower landscape sensitivity areas, and I just compare that to some of the notified zones. The Wide Creek has 13% lower landscape sensitivity, and the Lochlinny one 47% of lower landscape sensitivity. So that is quite high. By comparison, the Acadia Rural Visitor Zone has 15% lower landscape sensitivity, and Multipeak 14%. So comparatively, these zones are on par with what is what of the rural visitor zones that were notified. Paragraph 7 I'll just take as read. Probably just take the rest as read to speed things up a bit.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson.
Well, I don't particularly think it is necessary, but really it is just to, there was concern expressed through the 42A report about the scale of development that could occur within these new zones. So it's just a manner of putting a limit on that scale.
How would that be measured and enforced?
Pardon?
If there's a limit,
yes.
How would you estimation that would be measured or enforced?
It would be enforced through the resource consent process. It's in a rule, so if you exceed that, then you go from controlled activity to either discretionary or non-compliant.
So, again, with our practical sense, how would you measure the maximum number of visitors?
Well, when the council assess the resource consent application, it will be obvious as to what the application applies for in terms of the number of people.
What the visitor accommodation is permitted, though,
but
will we know resource consent?
Well, yeah. So once you exceed the 10 people, then you require resource consent.
Well, I guess what
the council
was saying is how will the council even know how many people
are there, but the suspects that you're saying? Really, it's no different to any other residential visitor accommodation in the district, where you are allowed permitted activity up to a certain threshold, and then after that, resource consent. So, it would be enforced through usually people making complaints or trade competitors.
Yes.
Well, it's not difficult to police, but people do through the complaints process or through monitoring. I know that in terms of visitor accommodation, the council a few years ago was very proactive in monitoring Airbnb, etc., to find out who was complying with the rules and who weren't. So.
Yes. Which is basically the creek through the middle of it.
Yes.
And he talks about debris flow channel down that creek. Now, it looks to me from the mapping that most of that's in a low sensitivity area. And he recommended a building restriction area over that. Do you have a tapped up on that?
No. I went back through Mr. Bond's rebuttal evidence and I didn't see that in there, but I do recall I did sit through Mr. Bond's examination. I do recall that question. I note that under Rule 46.46, which is the controlled activity rule for buildings, which would apply to that lower sensitivity area. The location of buildings, including natural hazards. So obviously you're not going to put a building in that water channel. So I think there is the protection there already.
Is a controlled activity control reserved to natural hazards that the council could require not to be put in that area?
Yes, absolutely. And
even if the applicant proposed it?
Yes, there is control over the location of buildings. But that said, if there was a no-build through that area, a no-build line restriction, I have no problem with that either.
No, exactly. Tell me about this rule about not being visible to the following. Sorry, I haven't
it's
46.5284.
Yeah, which is on 46.10 of my evidence, which is the the amended zoning provisions.
46.5284. Oh, so it's popped under a building coverage rule. That's no wonder I didn't find it.
Yes, it is.
It should be a separate rule,
isn't it? Yes, it could be. Yes.
And
I note I did make a mistake in that I said no building in the moderate high landscape sensitivity area shall be visible from the state highway. Mr. Espy's evidence is that any building in that Wide Creek zone should not be visible from the state highway. So
the low sensitivity area is a circle in the middle of the
yeah.
High. It'd be difficult to have visible from one but not the other.
Yeah, correct. Okay. So if you do approve the zone, I'd recommend the words in the moderate high landscape sensitivity area be taken out of that standard. And yeah, if it was a new standard, that would probably not get lost.
It's getting lost, I suppose, is the issue, isn't it? I mean, it's thought that it's there.
Yes.
No building in the block in the Wide Creek rural business zone shall be visible from State Highway 6.
Yes, that's certainly the intention.
All right, thank you very much. That's all the questions from me.
Thank you very much.
In which
Wide Creek.
I think I wrote that down in my submission somewhere. No, I didn't. It's approximately 1,850 square metres.
And the question I had was, shouldn't there be some diversion? Like, if we accept Mr. Espy's evidence that 1,800 square metres is an appropriate coverage for the whole zone, should that be divided so you couldn't entirely build out the low sensitivity area?
Or is it desirable to build out the low sensitivity area rather than going into the medium?
It sounds like this. You can have 100% building coverage of the low sensitivity area.
Yeah, that's a good question. Perhaps, perhaps given that it's discretionary activity in the medium high, then the building coverage in the low could be reduced even further. Well, well, I guess for say for a residential dwelling and some visitor accommodation units. For that house, 10 people, so say five couples. You know, you could certainly do that within 700 or 800 metres square. Yeah, so you could reduce. I agree, you could reduce that down if the building coverage was restricted to the low sensitivity area.
3.7 of your evidence.
Yes.
Could the 47.4.5 be formally used to accept that concrete?
Sorry, what was that, sir?
3.7.
Yes.
You've got 46.5, the formal airports, comma, lock winning station, Wide Creek.
Yes.
And then you've got another line, formal airports at lock winning station. Should the first line be formal airports except
air? Yes, Ms. Grace commented that in her rebuttal evidence, and I accept that.
Outside the
That is correct, but you are limited more in terms of how much aircraft movements in the rural zone than you are the rural visitor zone.
Thank you. Just two questions for me. They're slightly broader than just relating to monopoly.
Yes.
And it's interesting when you've got your markup version and you're representing other clients, each of them are looking for a different set of bespoke provisions, and I think just about every submitter has asked for some bespoke provisions. So I suppose the question is this a zone that's not fit for purpose? Everyone's asking for specific things.
Yes, it's... certainly in terms of the Acadia one, submission, which you'll hear in a few days, it is difficult. But you know, I guess that this submission comes from the original submission on stage one of the plan, which sought in high country stations farm base areas be provided for in the plan, where you can do this type of stuff. You can diversify your income essentially by having visitor accommodation and visitor activities within the farms. And the council, as I've said in my evidence, weren't keen on that approach because they considered it too untested. But certainly the proposed district plan, well, the operative plan provided for those zones and with that intention.
I understand that. So I meant just, so there is another question there. So I meant you find in your client review, do you advise, is that, you know, the best way is simply to apply for a resource consent?
That's also very difficult because there's a lot of cost involved with a resource consent. For example, to put a house on the White Creek site, just a house for the station, you know, go through a notified application of that, you know, you could spend over $100,000 easily.
So
and
sort of efficiency argument.
Yes.
And just the final question about was the one I already put. From your point of view, what you see is remote, but of course, this site is on the state highway. I know state highway spend money, but this is a pretty popular state highway. What's remote and what's its relevance?
I agree with Mr. Hespy's answer. It is, you know, for a rural visitor, which this zone is designed for. You know, a visitor standing in Queenstown Bay is remote. You only have to go 2 kilometres to the other side of the lake and be very remote. I recall the operative plan when that was publicly notified back in 1995. That included areas of remote recreation in the plan, and it identified Moat Lake as this remote area. And I wouldn't agree that is remote anymore as the district has developed over time. So you know, it is a very subjective term, and it is difficult to work out exactly what it means in the context of a district plan.
So you say obviously there's no
mean? I think to the people who enjoy the rural visitor experience within these zones, it does have meaning. But to local people who live here, probably not so much meaning.
Thank you.
And just a follow-up question, because I think Ms. Grace might have mentioned this. You've suggested in your markup version, adding to 46413, which is the non-compliant for residential activity, an exclusion in this case for the White Creek area for one residential dwelling. But where's the permitted, or the controlled or discretionary, where's the flip side of that? So what this one says is that one dwelling isn't non-complying at that site. But what are your intended? I mean,
Well, the building itself would either be controlled if it's in the low or discretionary or medium.
The way the plan's written, they separately control the activity to the building. So that would mean in a rural zone, there are residential activity dwellings as well as, like this is a residential activity dwelling, which says that it's not non-complying, but no, and then at 14.4.16, any other activity not listed is also non-complying.
For one residential activity to be a permitted activity, the building to also to require either control or,
control,
or discretionary.
Whereas doesn't this Turner say in one of the zones that the sort of contra position is whatever activity status it would be in the rural zone, which would be full discretionary, I think?
Yeah, 46.4.16, any other activity not listed in table
46.4.
Well, that's
clearly not what you're intending, because that means
no.
So your position in your mind, anyway, is that one residential dwelling on the Y Creek site, the activity would be permitted.
Yes.
But the building would be whatever buildings
controlled
are.
Controlled or discretionary.
Controlled under 46.4.6.
Yes, that's certainly the intention.
If it's in the low,
low
yes. area and discretionary, if it's in the other.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Just a point of clarity for me. Is you discuss farm-based areas.
Yes.
And you've got some experience in that. And you suggest introducing the PD, them into the PD through the acceptance of lock on lease submission. Is the scope to do that? As it was, because it was previously considered. Right?
Yes, I was referring there to the stage one submission of Loch Linley Station. So that is subject to appeal before the Environment Court at the moment. And the decision of the Commission was for the Council to look at doing a variation to introduce rural visitor zones to these sites, which the Council didn't do as part of stage three. Yeah, the submission on stage three that you're considering here isn't proposing farm-based areas.
Thank you. Good. Can I do one final question?
Yes.
Is White Creek area actually farmed? We were standing on the site looking at the
yes.
cliffs, separated by the road. Is that a practical farming site?
It certainly on the opposite side of the road there's a farm track that goes up into the mountains. I've walked up that probably it was about a year ago and there were stock up there then. So they certainly are. I understand that in the past they've used the road for stock to get stock from one end of the property to the other. And that is becoming impossible for them. I recall about 2 years ago they were driving a mob of sheep along there, and the traffic was backed up for miles, and Facebook was going going insane about all these complaints. But that is the difficulty they have having two high country stations with no infrastructure in the northern station.
I understand. Thank you very much.
basis we have to take that you will not miss your plane.
That'd be fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you, sir. And likewise, I'll try to help the gentleman behind catch his flight. Just speaking to two submissions before you, and really just to support and add to the Section 42 rebuttal where the council planner has accepted evidence that's been filed by ourselves. The first one, and I think it's not at all contentious, and never has been, which is the putting a visitor accommodation subzone within the Kinloch Township. The accommodation's been there since 1870, so we're a little bit mystified as to why it's never been picked up. I will hand out, just by way of context, some copies for you, which is the council's monitoring report on the Kinloch Township zone, which was produced for the district plan update, and you'll note with some irony the date of 2011 as to when the process was started. But it basically comes down to council's position back then that there should be protection for the businesses within that zone which aren't currently, they're basically on existing use rights. So as the owner of Kinloch Lodge, we obviously support having a visitor accommodation subzone because from a business point of view it gives a lot of certainty going forward. I think that's probably all we need to add a comment on that. The second submission we've made is in respect to the extent of the commercial precinct at the lower end of Mull Street in Glenorchy. I'm sure you've probably been there for your site visits. And really, I guess, just to point out that what we see now isn't what we've had and probably isn't what we will have again in the future. And I think if you were there 6 months ago, you would have seen a busy, bustling, thriving mob of people walking around the waterfront and the bottom end of Mull Street. So we have a visual accommodation business there and a small element of commercial. The submission I made in response to the Section 42 report was that the zone should go down the whole length of the street, and that has been accepted by Ms. Devlin. So really just to support to that. And then the only other thing I'd probably like to just briefly touch on since we've been invited to is the National Policy Statement on Urban Design. This is what I'll say, and maybe if what I'm saying is out of scope, then I'm sure we'll ignore it. But is the Glenorchy settlement zone part of an urban environment? And that depends on my reading as if it's considered part of the wider Queenstown housing and labour market. And I'd suggest the answer to that is yes, in the same way that Kingston, Gibson, the other outlying settlements are. So that's my brief reading of that. So to me that implies that the Glenorchy is within scope of this policy statement. But notwithstanding that, whilst the statement implies we make more efficient use of land and there's some intensification, then I'd probably submit at this stage that any widespread intensification of Glenorchy is probably contrary to the National Policy Statement for two reasons. First, Policy 3, or Objective 3, there's no public transport, and there's no plans to be public transport to that settlement. And secondly, because the settlement's not resilient to the natural hazards posed by climate change. And that's borne out, just put on record, that the current work that the Otago Regional Council are doing in drawing up a head of the lake adaptation strategy. And I think the reason they're doing that probably speaks for itself. And if there is a presumption against intensification, probably within scope would be how, within the Glenorchy context, do the panel feel about the residential flat proposal? Because on the face of it, it's a good, efficient use of land, but you could be seeing its intensification. And so you just appreciate these are very, very brief comments drawn up at short notice. And lastly, the absolute requirement on council at paragraph 338 of the policy statement to remove any rules from the district plan that specify any level of parking requirement. Now, the policy statement, that needs to be done as soon as it's practicable. My suggestion and submission is that this process, this stream that you're hearing, could do that for the settlement rules, because this is the most practicable, soonest opportunity to do that. There are a bunch of rules in the proposed zone and standards, which I've got written down, all of which specify parking requirements and refer back to chapter 29. So maybe it would be appropriate just to deal with those at this stage. And that is the end of my submission.
The last one is very good, but we're going to have to find out if there's in fact a submission that would support that, because we can only make changes that are even those that would implement the MPS,
yep,
still need a submission,
yep,
to give us jurisdiction.
I appreciate if it's out of scope, it's out of scope, but I thought nonetheless,
yeah,
it's appropriate to raise it.
It's good for contention. I applaud you massively for trying to get Monarchy into an urban environment. There's bulls and there's bulls, but that's a lot longer. But no, no question for me, sir. And off the yes, I appreciate you drawing that link to the NPS. You were here when you started. I just discussed it with the council and all the other parties. But we're in the process of getting our heads around it. And so triggers like that, I think, make us think about that very well.
Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you for, well, since it's part of the Queenstown housing and labour market, I'm sure it's just a top scoop of the jump.
It is indeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take the gentleman.